Chapter 5. Cabrillo had spent the first half hour of the flight in the back of the Gulfstream 5's luxurious cabin in contact with Max Hanley. Hanley was the corporation's vice president, the Oregon's chief engineer, and Juan's best friend. He'd been with Juan since he'd first conceived the idea of a private security company based on a ship. All the crew knew this, but one story few had heard was how the two men had hooked up in the first place. Cabrillo had spent his professional career as an NOC, a non-official cover, for the Central Intelligence Agency. This was bureaucratic speak for a spook, fluent in Arabic, Russian, as well as Spanish and English. He'd been posted to some of the hottest spots in the world, and had gotten himself into and out of more jams than he could count. When he'd come to the realization, soon after the Berlin Wall fell, that the end of the Cold War would mean an increase in regional conflicts, and that none of America's intelligence agencies were going to be adroit enough to respond, he'd decided to go out on his own as a private contractor. The corporation would tackle those jobs that were so black no one else could handle them with any kind of deniability. Juan had enough contacts in the government to ensure they would be busy for years. He'd talked it over with Langston Overholt, his mentor. Lang had regretfully agreed with Cabrillo's assessment. He hated to lose his star agent, but also recognized the possibilities the corporation would give him. He'd suggested that Juan track down one Maxwell Hanley. When asked who Hanley was, Lang had explained that he'd been the chief engineer aboard the Glomar Explorer, the famed Howard Hughes-built ship that had partially raised the Soviet Gulf-class submarine K-129. Juan had protested that the Glomar had done its thing in 1974, which would make Hanley simply too old to work as a mercenary. Lang had told him, in turn, that Hanley wasn't on that first expedition, but a later one that was still classified top secret. Hanley had overseen the ship's operations while she was supposedly mothballed at Suisun Bay in California. In fact, they had mocked up an old freighter to look like the Glomar Explorer while they had taken her to a spot off the Azores Islands to raise a Typhoon-class ballistic missile submarine with its full complement of 20 ICBMs and 200 nuclear warheads. That had been in 1984, and while Hanley had gotten his start as a riverine warrior in Vietnam, he was too ornery to be considered old. Cabrillo found Max running a scrapyard outside of Barstow, California, and in the course of 10 minutes had him tossing the keys to the place to his assistant and heading out the door. By the time the Oregon had been selected as their base of operations and her conversion work completed in Vladivostok by a corrupt Russian admiral who loved Yankee dollars and Korean girls in equal measure, the two men were like an old married couple. Sure, they argued, but they never lost respect for each other. Hanley later admitted he would have followed Juan out of the junkyard after the first 60 seconds of his pitch.
"So, that's him on paper," Max said over the secure phone link.
He was aboard their ship, still anchored just off Karachi.
"Pretty damned impressive," Juan opined.
He'd called Max as they were driving along the 6-lane superhighway connecting the Khyber Pass to Islamabad, and asked him to run a full background check on Marion McDougal Lawless.
2 years at Tulane, but he left and joined the army as a 912er.
Meaning the day after the September 11th terrorist attacks, he'd walked into an army recruiting station and signed on as a common soldier, like thousands of other brave men and women.
Got into the Rangers, excelled by all accounts. He racked up a couple of combat citations and, after 8 years, opted out to join up with Fortran Security as a private contractor. "Same skill set as a Ranger," Max said. only 10 times the pay.
I know, Fortran, Juan countered. They're a top-notch outfit, so they pay more like 20 times.
Whatever, Max said in his normally irritated manner. He's got an ex-wife and a daughter. Nearly all his pay goes to an address in New Orleans that I can only assume is the ex.
Only one, huh? Juan teased. Max had 3, and alimony payments to all of them.
We're in the middle of a recession. There are thousands of out-of-work comedians out there, and you think you are funny? Talk about delusions of grandeur. Anyway, like I said, that's him on paper. What's the real version like?
Max, I'll tell you, he's been beat 6 ways to Sunday, and while I'm rubbernecking a technical getting blown up, he sees the Predator I know is out there fire its missile and moves like nothing I've ever seen before. He saved our lives, no 2 ways about it.
So? Hanley prompted.
Since we lost Jerry Pulaski in Argentina, we've been down one gun dog. I want to talk it over with Eddie, as head of shore operations, and Link as our lead warfighter, but I think we might have our replacement. He was an Army Ranger for 8 years and has spent a lot of time deep in the ugliness. Not to mention he managed to impress me in just over an hour of knowing him.
What about his contract with Fortran? Max asked. Also, I would like to verify the story of how he got captured. Just playing devil's advocate, but maybe this guy's lost his edge.
I'll talk to him and follow up with you before I make any decision, Cabrillo promised. Any word from Setiawan's dad?
There's an air ambulance jet at Karachi Airport. The old man didn't come, but he sent his wife and the kid's grandparents. I let them know as soon as you hit the Islamabad road that you would be here soon. What's your ETA?
Another 40 minutes.
Okay. George is already on the tarmac in the chopper to ferry you guys out to the ship, and we've maybe got another job lined up.
Really? That was fast.
Came through from L'Enfant. Some Swiss financier's daughter crossed the border from Bangladesh into Myanmar, and he now can't raise her on her sat phone. He's afraid something's happened to her and wants us to get her out.
2 questions, Juan said. What's she doing in that godforsaken area in the first place? And second, has he been in contact with the government? The first was really rhetorical. It didn't matter. But the second was critical.
No, he's a smart guy. He knew that if he reached out to the ruling junta, his daughter would be hunted down and either ransomed or imprisoned for life.
That's good. Listen, we'll talk about it when we get back to the ship. Meanwhile, start a background check on the financier and his daughter and anyone she was traveling with.
Eric and Mark are already on it.
Oh, too, if McDee comes back with us, it'll be on a limited access basis for now. Tell Hux to bring her medical bag to meet us. I want her to make sure the guy's not worse off than he's letting on.
Ranger tough, huh?
Macho 101 is the first class they teach at Benning. Juan killed the connection. In the main cabin of the executive jet, Linda was bent over Seti, checking on his condition. He asked how the boy was doing.
The sedative's starting to wear off. I don't want to risk giving him any more, but I also don't want him regaining consciousness before we transfer him.
They have an air ambulance waiting. If you juice him a little, they'll be able to handle it.
Okay.
Link and McDee Lawless were swapping Afghanistan war stories. Link's had been one of the first pairs of boots on the ground, while McDee hadn't gotten into the country until a few years later. They didn't know any of the same people, but the situations they'd faced were usually similar, especially when dealing with the locals.
Pardon the interruption, Juan said. McDee, can I have a word with you?
Sure.
He set aside the bottled water he'd been sipping and limped after the chairman to the rear of the aircraft.
What's up?
How'd it happen?
Lawless immediately grasped what he was being asked.
There were 3 of us guarding a Pakistani TV crew, myself and 2 locals we'd worked with before. We were about an hour out of Kabul when the cameraman asks us to pull over. I tell him it's a real bad idea, but he said it was an emergency. The terrain was clear, so I figure what the hell. We pull over, and no sooner had the wheels stopped turning than about a dozen Taliban materialize out of the ground. They'd been hiding under blankets that they covered with sand. It was a perfect ambush. I didn't even get a shot off. The camera crew was a plant. They killed the two Afghan guards on the spot and trussed me up like a Thanksgiving turkey. They stole our truck and, well, you pretty much know the rest. At some point, I was transferred to the trunk of a car, I think, before we crossed into Pakistan, but there's no way to be sure. Whenever they got the chance, they'd smack me around some and brag about how I was going to be a hit on the Al-Qaeda version of YouTube. He spoke as if he were reporting the events of someone else's life. Cabrillo suspected that it was still too fresh in his mind. The one thing he could tell was that Lawless regretted what had happened to the two Afghans more than his own capture. "By now," Juan said, "you've figured out what we do, yes?" "Private security, like Fortran." "It goes well beyond that. We're also an intelligence gathering operation. We do some consultancy, and we take on some ops for Uncle Sam when he needs complete deniability. Though, for reasons that aren't important right now, that line of work has dried up for the time being. We thoroughly vet all our clients. We work only for the good guys, if you follow my meaning. And we work so far under the grid that only a handful of people in the world know who we are. Your bosses at Fortran, for example, have no idea. You won't see us mentioned in the media because I run a tight outfit that leaves no room for error."
"Sounds like a pretty good crew," Lawless said neutrally.
"It's the best at what it does. Each member has been handpicked, and when someone new comes aboard, everyone gets a vote."
"Are you offering me a job?"
"Provisionally. A couple months ago, we lost a man. Jerry Pulaski was his name. He was what we called a gun dog, a hardened combat veteran used mostly for when the fur starts flying. You'd fill his position."
"Do you guys mostly operate in this area?"
"No. Actually, this is our first time here. This whole region's lousy with outfits like yours and Blackwater, or whatever they call themselves these days. We'd just as soon leave it to them. This rescue was a one-time type of deal."
"My contract with Fortran runs for another few months," Lawless told him.
"Don't you think, after what happened to you, that they would let you out of it?"
"Yeah, probably," he drawled. "Listen, though, I've got a little girl to support."
He paused, swallowed, and went on. "My folks are raising her, and they need the extra money I make."
"What were you being paid?" Juan asked bluntly.
McD gave him the number, which sounded reasonable.
"Okay. You'll keep making that during your probationary period. After that, if things work out, you'll become a full member of the corporation and share in the profits."
Are y'all profitable?"
Cabrillo responded by asking, "What do you think this plane's worth?" Lawless looked around for just a second.
"G5, like this? About $50 million?
54, to be exact," Juan told him. "We paid cash." They handed over a still-sleeping Setiawan to his tearful mother on the tarmac between the corporation's aircraft and a chartered Citation fitted out as a flying hospital. The grandmother, too, was weeping, while the grandfather watched the exchange stoically. Arrangements had already been made to have customs and immigration look the other way. They whisked the boy onto the idling jet, and as soon as the door was closed and sealed, it began to roll. Juan had planned to send their plane out of the country, but with the possibility of a new job soon, he told the pilot to park it and find himself a hotel room in the city. They hefted their guns and equipment in nondescript nylon bags and made their way to where a row of helicopters was backed up to a cyclone fence about 50 yards from the General Aviation Terminal building. These were all civilian choppers. For the most part, they were painted white with a stripe of color across their noses and along their flanks. One, however, was a glossy black and looked as menacing as a gunship, though she carried no visible weapons. This was the corporation's MD-520N, a state-of-the-art helo that vented exhaust through its tail rather than relying on a secondary rotor. This NOTAR system made it the quietest jet-powered helicopter in the world. The pilot saw the four men and one woman approaching and began hitting switches in the cockpit to fire the turbine. It would be a tight squeeze, but the 520 had more than enough power to take them all out to the Oregon.
"Looks like it went well,"
the pilot remarked when Juan opened the passenger door and shoved his equipment bag under his seat.
"Nothing to it," Cabrillo said in typical fashion.
George Gomez Adams knew better. The veteran pilot could tell by their swagger when they were approaching that things had gotten dicey and that they'd handled it well.
"Who's the new guy?"
"McD Lawless. He's a Fortran operative who got nabbed outside of Kabul. Seemed a waste to let them behead him."
"We keeping him?"
"Maybe."
"I don't like guys who are better looking than me," Gomez said.
With his gunslinger mustache and matinee idol looks, there weren't many men in the world who qualified.
"Can't handle a little competition," Juan grinned.
"Exactly."
Adams looked over his shoulder and thrust out his hand to McD.
"So long as you never beat me out with the ladies, we'll be fine."
It was clear Lawless had no idea what to make of that statement, but he shook Adams's hand anyway.
"No problem. So long as you never crash with me aboard, we'll be better than fine."
"Deal."
Gomez turned his attention back to the chopper, radioing the control tower to get flight authorization. Juan said to Lawless,
"When we get to the ship, the first thing we'll do is get you a secure link to your people. They must be going nuts about now. Same thing with your folks, if they've been told."
"I doubt Fortran would have contacted them yet. I was grabbed less than 48 hours ago."
"Okay, one less thing to worry about."
A minute later, the turbine shrieked as Adams fed in more power. The airframe shuddered, and then everything became smooth when the skids lifted from the concrete pad. Gomez fought his instincts to hot-dog it, so they rose at a sedate pace and started flying out over the mangroves and mudflats to the north of the sprawling city of 15 million. A dense pall of smog cut visibility dramatically, so that Karachi's office towers and high-rise apartment buildings appeared indistinct in the distance. Everything looked like the color of rust, the buildings, the air, even the water in the enclosed inner harbor. It was only when one looked west, out toward the ocean, that there was any true color. The water was a deep sapphire blue. They flashed over the China Creek, where the main port was located, and Baba Channel, which led to the open sea. It was crowded with all manner of shipping awaiting its turn at the docks. They flew beyond the barrier islands, and soon the smog gave way to clear air. The sun cast a dazzling silver strip across the waves as it rose higher into the sky behind them. More ships were streaming toward the port or were outbound laden with goods. Their wakes were like white scars. One ship directly ahead of them showed no wake. By modern standards, she was just mid-sized at over 560 feet. The container ship passing off her port side was over twice as long. Their target was also of an outdated design, built prior to the industry switchover to standardized containers. She was designed to carry her cargo in five deep holds, each secured with a hatch and serviced by a quintet of spindly derricks. Her superstructure was placed just aft of amidships and was topped by a single funnel, bridge wings and catwalks hung off it like wrought iron fire escapes. She carried two lifeboats in davits above the main deck. Her bow was like an axe head, while her fantail had a little of that champagne glass elegance. All this could be seen from a distance. It wasn't until the chopper was much closer that details emerged. The ship was a rust bucket, a scow that should have been chopped into scrap years ago. Paint peeled in patches all over her hull and decking, as if she were infected with some sort of maritime eczema. The paint scheme itself was a patchwork of mismatched colors, daubed over one another with no eye at all for aesthetics. Rust formed in pools on the deck, oozed from scuppers and the hawse hole, and streaked the sides of the superstructure like reddish-brown guano. The deck was a tangled jumble of broken machinery, oil drums, and various other junk, including, inexplicably, a washing machine and a massive tire from a tractor. "You got to be kidding me," McDee muttered when the true nature of the ship was revealed. "Is this some sort of con?"
"She may not be pretty," Gomez Adams said, "but she sure is ugly."
"Trust me when I tell you that it's not what it seems," Juan assured him. "For the time being, we're not going to let you in on any of her secrets, but secrets she has."
"What, that she was Teddy Roosevelt's troop ship when he went to Cuba?"
Juan laughed. Link added,
"No, the Oregon was Noah's first attempt at the Ark."
"I'd believe that one, too."
Gomez swooped around to the aft of the ship, where there was a helipad marked out on the rearmost cargo hatch. A crewman stood by in case the pilot needed help landing, but Adams didn't need any directions. He flared the chopper directly over the big, faded letter H and settled it in the exact center. He killed the engine, and its persistent whine died down to silence, and the rotor blades emerged from their shimmering mirage of motion as they slowed.
"Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the MV Oregon," Adams said. "The current temperature is 68 degrees. The local time is 11:18. Please be aware that items in the overhead may have shifted during our flight. Thank you for flying with us today, and we hope you will use us in the future."
"Forget it," Linda told him as she opened the rear door. "Your rewards program sucks, and my peanuts were stale."
Juan once again marveled at the team he had assembled. Less than 12 hours earlier, they had been rolling down the side of a mountain with a Hellfire missile boring in on them, and now they were joking, as if they didn't have a care in the world. He reminded himself that he shouldn't be too surprised. This was the kind of life they had chosen for themselves. If they couldn't joke about it afterward, they wouldn't last 5 minutes. Max Hanley approached from the safety of the superstructure. In deference to the sun, he had a battered Dodgers cap covering what little remained of his ginger hair. Hanley was a little above average in height and was starting to show his age around his middle and in the wrinkles spider-webbing from the corners of his eyes, but he moved well, and with his anvil-sized hands he could take care of himself with no problem. He wore coveralls that showed a spot of grease on one elbow, meaning he had just come up from the Oregon's revolutionary engine room. With him was Dr. Julia Huxley. A Navy-trained physician, Hux wore a customary white coat over her lush 1950s pin-up curves, with her hair tied back in a ponytail. Brisk, almost brusque when she was working on a patient, she was easygoing the rest of the time. She'd been Juan's doctor when he had part of his leg blown off by a Chinese gunboat years earlier, when the corporation was on a mission for NUMA, the National Underwater and Marine Agency. She'd overseen his rehab, staying by him as he went from a man who couldn't walk to one who could run for miles without a trace of a limp. She and Max were also the only two people in the world who knew that Cabrillo's missing foot and ankle ached every minute of every day. It was called phantom pain,
a common experience for amputees. To Juan, there was nothing phantom about it. Just because he couldn't see his foot or touch it didn't mean the damned thing didn't hurt all the time.
I confirmed the wire transfer from Bahar's account to ours, Max said by way of greeting.
We're all fine, Juan countered. Thanks for asking.
Don't be such a wuss, Max said flatly. I talked to you an hour ago. I know you're fine. Besides, money is more important to me than your health.
You're all heart, buddy. Juan waved McDee forward. Max Hanley, Julia Huxley, this is McDee Lawless. McDee, this is my second in command and the ship's sawbones. And I mean that literally. They all shook hands. Let's get McDee up to my office so Hux can give him the once-over.
The interior of the ship was just as bad as her scabrous hide. Chipped linoleum floors, weak lighting, and dust bunnies the size of tumbleweeds. Lead paint and asbestos appeared to be the decorator's preferred mediums.
Jesus, McDee cried. This ship is like a toxic waste dump. Should I even breathe in here?
Sure, Link replied, his barrel chest expanding as he filled his lungs. Real shallow-like.
He then slapped the back of his hand against Lawless's taut belly.
Relax, man. It ain't what you think. The chairman will show you. Go off with the doc, and then you'll see.
Huxley invited McDee into one of the cabins behind the bridge and set her bag down on the dresser in preparation for her exam. Link, Juan, and Max continued on to the bridge itself. Linda begged out of the meeting, saying she needed a 2-hour soak in the spa tub in her cabin. There were no officers of the deck or watchstanders on the bridge. They would only bother with such a formality if there were shipping close by or a harbor pilot or customs official were aboard. Otherwise, the wheelhouse remained empty. The room was broad, with wood and glass doors on either end to access the flying bridges. The wheel was a big, old-fashioned spoked affair with handholds made smooth by countless years of wear. The windows were frosted with salt rime and barely translucent. The equipment was generations out of date. The radio looked like something Marconi himself had assembled. The bright work, like the standalone engine controls, hadn't seen polish since it was installed. The wooden chart cabinets were chipped and their tops stained by greasy food and spilled coffee. To all outward appearances, it was perhaps the sorriest excuse for a pilot house afloat. Just seconds after they entered the bridge, an elderly gentleman, dressed in black slacks and a crisp white shirt with an unblemished apron around his waist, materialized as though from thin air. His hair was as white as his starched shirt, his face both gaunt and wrinkled. He carried a sterling silver tray with a dewy pitcher of some tropical-looking concoction and crystal glasses.
"The sun's over the yardarm someplace," he said in a crisp British accent.
"What's this, Maurice?" Juan asked, as the ship's steward handed out glasses and began to pour. Link looked at his drink sourly and then brightened when the steward produced a bottle of Heineken from his apron. Link popped the top by ramming it against the chart table.
"A little juice, a little grog, this and that. I figured you could use something after the mission."
Cabrillo took a sip and announced, "Nectar of the gods, my friend. Absolute nectar of the gods."
Maurice didn't acknowledge the compliment. He already knew how good the drink was and didn't need to be told. He set the platter aside. Under it was a rosewood cigar box that usually sat on Cabrillo's desk in his cabin. Max demurred, pulling a pipe and a leather pouch from the back pocket of his coveralls. In moments, the air was as thick as an Amazonian forest fire. The steward left the bridge as silently as he'd arrived, his polished shoes somehow not making a noise on the filthy linoleum deck covering.
"Okay, so tell me about this new op,"
Cabrillo invited, blowing a plume of smoke toward the ceiling while Max opened one of the wing doors for a little ventilation.
The financier's name is Roland Quasar from Basel. His daughter is Soleil, aged 30. She's got a reputation for being something of a daredevil. She's already got her spot bought and paid for when Virgin Galactic starts up their suborbital flights. She's climbed the highest mountains on 6 of the 7 continents. She's been beaten back by Everest twice. She raced as a pay-for-play GP2 driver for a season. For those that don't know, that's one tier below Formula One racing. She's also a scratch golfer, was a world-ranked tennis player in her teens, and just missed the cut for the Swiss Olympic fencing team.
Accomplished woman, Juan remarked.
Quite, Max agreed. I'd show you a picture, but you'd start drooling on the spot. Anyway, she and a friend went backpacking in Bangladesh. Judging by the GPS logs her father sent, she made a beeline for the border with Myanmar and kept on hiking.
Sounds deliberate to me, Link said, finishing his beer.
The 12-ouncer looked like a Tabasco bottle in his hand.
Does he know what she was up to?
No idea. He said that she rarely kept him informed of what she was doing. I get the impression there's a little bad blood between them. When I ran the background check on him, it showed there was a divorce when Soleil was 17, and he subsequently remarried a few months later.
Where's the mother? Juan asked, nonchalantly tapping ash onto the already grimy floor.
Died of pancreatic cancer 5 years ago. Before that, she lived in Zurich, which is now Soleil's home.
And what's the father's story?
Works for one of those Swiss banks shady people like us keep our money in. Murph and Stone didn't turn up anything through regular and not-so-regular financial channels. Crossar is legit, as far as we can tell.
Did you ask Langston?
For all we know, he's Bin Laden's personal banker. Actually, he's helped the agency track funds heading to the Jamaa Islamiyah terrorist group.
Could this be payback? Cabrillo wondered aloud. Maybe they snatched her.
Anything's possible at this point, Max replied. It could be that, or local drug lords, or it could be her phone's on the fritz and she's hiking out as we speak.
How long ago did she go dark? Link asked.
She'd been checking in once a week, missed her regular call 4 days ago. Quasar let it go a day before he got edgy. He made some calls, first to his contact at Langley over the money laundering thing, and eventually he tracked down L'Enfant.
Was the phone transmitting her GPS coordinates the whole time?
No, Max said. She only turned it on when she was calling in.
Juan tapped ash from his cigar. So, at the outside, she could have been snatched 12 days ago.
Yes, Max agreed glumly.
And all we have to go on is her last known location, which, again, is 11 days old. This time, Hanley merely nodded. This won't be easy. We're talking minor needle, major haystack.
$5 million to make the attempt, Max added. Another 2 if we bring her out.
They were interrupted by Julia Huxley. She entered the bridge from the corridor that linked the 6 cabins on that deck, all of which were as shabby as the wheelhouse itself.
What's the word? Juan asked.
Physically, he's fine. He's got some pretty deep contusions across his abdomen and lower chest, his upper arms, thighs, and his cute-as-a-button buttocks. Nothing is sprained as far as I can tell, but he says his knees and ankles hurt like heck. Give him a week and he'll be good as new. I've still got to run some samples back in my lab, but from what he told me, he's as healthy as a horse. I have no reason to doubt that.
Send him out to us, and thanks.
No, thank you.
A moment later, Lawless stepped onto the bridge, tucking a clean T-shirt into his combat pants. He looked around a moment and said,
"Y'all don't pay your maid enough."
"It's been her week off since 2002,
Cabrillo deadpanned.
"Well, the doc says you check out, and her word's good enough for me. What do you say?"
"I've got to be honest with you, Chairman Cabrillo," McDee replied. "Since coming aboard your ship, I'm having second thoughts. You say you make money hand over fist, but living on this scow isn't exactly my cup of joe."
"What if I were to tell you that under all this rust and grime is a ship that has more luxury appointments than the finest yacht you've ever seen?"
"I'd say you'd have to show me."
"Juan," Max said in a questioning voice.
"It's okay," Cabrillo said. "Just a taste, nothing more." Cabrillo indicated that Lawless should follow him. They made their way down a flight of internal stairs and through a few dingy hallways until they reached a windowless mess hall. Tacky travel posters were taped to the matte gray walls. Beyond the pass-through was a kitchen that would turn a health inspector's stomach. Stalactites of congealed grease clung to the hood above the six-burner stove, while the flies, buzzing around a sink full of dirty dishes, rivaled the air traffic pattern over O'Hare. Juan walked up to one of the posters on the wall opposite the entrance. It depicted a beautiful Tahitian girl in a bikini, standing on a beach in front of a grove of palm trees. He bent close and looked to be peering into her navel. A section of wall clicked open. The door had been so cleverly concealed that Lawless hadn't seen a thing. Cabrillo straightened.
"Retinal scanner," he explained, and pulled the door all the way open.
He motioned for McDee to take a look. He stared, gape-jawed. The carpet on the floor was a rich burgundy, and so thick it looked like it could conceal a crouching lion. Polished mahogany wainscoting adorned the walls. Above it was some material that resembled regular residential sheetrock, but couldn't possibly be, because a ship at sea vibrated too much. It was painted a subtle gray with hints of mauve, very relaxing, very soothing. The lighting was either tasteful sconces hanging on the walls or cut crystal chandeliers. Lawless was no art expert, but he was pretty sure the canvases in gilt frames were the real deal, and he recognized one even if he couldn't name Winslow Homer as its painter. This wasn't a passageway on some broken-down old freighter. This belonged to a 5-star resort hotel. Heck, 8 stars, for all he knew. He looked at the chairman, confusion written all over his face. Juan began to answer his unasked question.
"What you see topside is all deception. The rust, the dirt, the sorry state of the equipment. It's all designed to make the Oregon as innocuous as possible. Anonymity is the name of the game. With this ship, we can pull into any port in the world and not arouse suspicion. It's like when you're on the freeway. You notice the Ferraris and Porsches, but do you give a second's thought to some mid-90s Buick Regal? The best part," he went on, "is that we have the ways and means to disguise her silhouette and change her name in about 12 hours. She's never the same ship from mission to mission. We call her the Oregon, but that is rarely the name painted on her transom."
"So the rest of the ship is like this," Juan said, pointing down the hallway. "Each crew member has a private cabin and a decorating allowance, I might add. We have a gym, pool, dojo, sauna. Our head chef and sous chef both trained at Le Cordon Bleu. You've met our onboard doctor, and as you can imagine, she demanded and got the latest medical equipment available."
"What about weapons?"
"There's a full armory, with everything from pistols to shoulder-fired anti-tank missiles." It wasn't yet time to tell him that the Oregon herself was a floating arsenal that would rival most Navy's capital ships. That, and some of the vessel's other hidden tricks, would remain secret until Lawless completed his probationary period. "Now, what do you say?" Lawless smiled and thrust out his hand.
"I'll call Fortran and give him my notice."
From down the hallway came a whoop from an unseen female crew member. It didn't sound like Hux or Linda, so word had traveled fast about the Adonis-like newbie.
"It might take some time," McDee continued, "and I'll probably have to go back to Kabul. I'm sure they're investigating my kidnapping. Plus, I'll need to pick up my passport and personal kit."
"No problem," Juan assured him. "We need a few days to get into position for our next job. We'll issue you one of our encrypted satellite phones and contact numbers. We'll have to fly you out to meet us." Juan had a sudden thought. "By the way, how are your tracking skills?"
"I'm a redneck at heart. Spent my summers hunting in the bayous. My dad used to boast that he had the dogs carrying the guns and me following the scent.